Good morning and welcome to the January morning panel of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. I am Mike Pirtle from Omaha, and I'm pleased to be joined today on my right by our Chief Judge Frankie Moore from North Platte, and on my left, Judge Everett Inbody from Wahoo. We have four cases on our docket this morning. We will take them in the order listed. This is being streamed live on our court website, NET. So if there's any information of a sensitive nature, such as juvenile cases, things like that, you might want to use first names only. I will call the case twice for purposes of the recording. Our first case is Kaiser versus Grinnell. You may approach. First case is Kaiser versus Grinnell. Good morning, Mr. Wagner.
Good morning, Madam Chief Judge, members of the court. May it please the court, I am Jeffrey Wagner. I am the attorney for the appellant herein. This case arises out of a paternity proceeding, custody proceeding, before the District Court of Washington County, Nebraska. The plaintiff, or the appellant and the appellee in this matter, have never been married. They have one minor child born in 2011. Appellee filed a complaint to establish paternity in January of 2014. Matter didn't begin proceeding to trial until September of 2015. In September of 2015, the appellee filed a motion asking for some specific information about the boyfriend of the appellant. That information was provided to the appellee prior to trial. In that motion, appellee stated, in addition to the statements the defendant has made to the boyfriend, and I'm paraphrasing here, those statements are admissible evidence. It's believed that the defendant has made statements to the boyfriend about his pending custody case and about plaintiff himself. On September 9th, the appellee issued a subpoena to the boyfriend to appear for the first day of trial. Interrogatories were issued in this matter back in July of 2014. I was the second counsel for appellant in this matter. Those answers were answered shortly after they were served. Trial commenced in
and the
September.
Boyfriend wasn't disclosed on those answers, is that my understanding?
There was no boyfriend disclosed on those answers at the time they were answered, correct. Mm-hmm. Trial commenced in September, on September 14th, and continued on September 15th. Appellee attended to secure service upon the boyfriend. He did not perfect service. However, this trial did not conclude in 2 days in September. This trial went on for a period of almost 5 months on various days during a five-month period of time.
And counsel, we don't have anything in our record, such as a return of service, to know what happened with the subpoena, correct?
You do if you look in the comments by the court, because Judge Sampson comments that there was no service upon Cunningham for the first 2 days of trial, but he goes on to state it does not appear that he dodged service. And then after the attempt of service in September, there's no other attempts in the record that Cunningham was ever subpoenaed again for any of the other days of trial. There's nothing in the record that he was ever, there was any attempt to depose him or somehow secure his appearance.
There's no evidence that that happened or didn't happen.
Correct. Okay. There's nothing in the record that would reflect that.
Right.
The matter proceeded to trial. The appellee called 13 witnesses in this and presented over 50 exhibits. The appellee knew of the boyfriend, did nothing to secure his attendance. On February 19th...
Is there any evidence that the appellee knew of the text messages that are the subject of the motion for new trial during any of the trial dates?
There is nothing in the record to indicate that he knew of the text messages.
And in fact... text messages had been requested in a request for production?
Text messages had been requested in a request for production in July of 2014. Mm-hmm. There had been no supplemental request for productions after that date.
Or supplemental answers.
Or supplemental answers, or supplemental responses. But there's nothing in the record to indicate that the responses and the answers weren't true and accurate at the time they were given.
Wasn't the request for production with regard to text messages concerning custody?
I think the request was text messages concerning the issues related to the litigation.
Which were custody.
Which would generally be custody. But when those requests were made and answered, well, there's nothing to show that when they were made and answered back in 2014, all the relevant information was provided. What this record doesn't show is, well...
I guess you can't talk about that, right?
I'm going to get to that. In February, on February 19th, the court issued a decree of paternity and awarded the appellant custody of the minor child. On February 29th, Appellee filed a motion for a new trial, all combined with a motion to alter or amend or a motion to clarify. Ultimately, that motion was granted by the trial court. I assume, by the language of the order, the court was simply granting the motion for a new trial. The appellant's position is that the trial court erred in granting that order. First of all, the evidence was not newly discovered. Second of all, the evidence was not of such a nature, the evidence that's alleged, that it would likely result in a different outcome in this proceeding. And third, the appellee knew of the boyfriend, had his information, and did nothing to secure his attendance during the 5 months that this trial pended.
Weren't there two reasons why the court granted the new trial? One being the information, the correspondence between the mother and the boyfriend, and the other was the information that was contained on, I believe, an iPad?
There were two issues raised by the appellee in the motion for a new trial. A text message located on the iPad and some images located on the iPad. However, you cannot tell from the evidence presented to the court by the appellee when those images were taken. You cannot tell when those text messages were created. And frankly, this all occurs well after the trial. This isn't newly discovered evidence. It may be new evidence, but it's not newly discovered. And the proper remedy for the appellee would have been to file a complaint to modify based on this new information.
Don't some of the screenshots show the year 2015?
Some of the screenshots show information on one side related to messages of different characters, but none of the screenshots specifically show when the images were created, and there is no evidence that those images were ever shown to the child or the child ever saw those images until after the trial, when she's in the custody of the father. And as my client's affidavit shows, she asked the father not to give the child access to the iPad, but all of a sudden the father has the child having access to the iPad, and as the appellant shows, he had to scroll through almost 1,800 text messages a four-year-old would have had to before they get anything regarding this.
Wasn't the trial court concerned, though, and the evidence showed that the child had access to this iPad?
It showed that
prior to the time of discovery.
The evidence showed the child had access to the iPad under the mother's supervision, but there's no evidence, none, that the child ever saw any of these images.
But again, wasn't the trial court's concern the access?
I think the trial court was concerned about the access, but absent evidence to show that the child ever had access. It's like any parent with a computer at home, the child may have access to any sort of information on the internet, but until something happens or there's some concrete information that the child's somehow been exposed to something inappropriate, that's just speculation.
But isn't it different if it's downloaded on a device as opposed to having access to the internet?
I don't see how so. If someone has a computer that's unfiltered, with unfettered access to the internet in their home, any child... kids are quite adept, I have a few of them myself, can get on a computer and go all sorts of places and find all sorts of information. But parents who supervise their children, and there's no evidence that my client did not supervise her child, that child was ever exposed to those images.
The court found that had it been aware of these text messages and these images, that it might have ruled differently than it did. Isn't that kind of the bottom line here?
I don't think the court found it might have ruled differently, and I don't think the might should be the standard. I think the evidence has to be so persuasive that the court would have ruled differently based on that evidence had it been known to the court, and that's not the standard here. That's not what happened here.
Isn't the trial judge in the best position to determine whether the information would probably have resulted in a different outcome?
I think the trial judge would be in the best position because this was tried to the bench. However, that is not the finding that was made by Judge Sampson. Could have, would have, should have, is not the standard before this court or before that court in granting a motion for a new trial.
I think the word is probably.
I think the word is probably, but that's not the word that Judge Sampson used. And that's not the finding Judge Sampson made. Lastly, I would ask the court to consider that Appley knew of this person, that Appley had been provided his address, that Appley never deposed him, never attempted but for one subpoena to get him to appear at trial, never asked for a special process server or any assistant from the court in getting this gentleman to court. Appley did not do all he reasonably could have, reasonably would have contacted him. And I do think the court has to take into consideration that the duty to supplement under the court rules, if those answers are true at the time they're given, and there's no evidence that they weren't, there's no duty to supplement unless something would be misleading in there, and there was nothing misleading in the answers when made. So the answers were truthfully made at the time they were answered. He could have asked in deposition testimony, and the deposition's in the record, about the boyfriend or communications, but he did not.
So if I ask you in an interrogatory to name anybody who has any information about the facts or issues involved in this matter, and you don't disclose the boyfriend, is it your position that, you know, 60 days later, if there's a boyfriend, she doesn't have a duty to amend?
If the boyfriend wasn't there when those questions were answered, because we all have new people that come in and out of our lives, and this is a case that went on for 2 years. If the boyfriend wasn't there, and there's no evidence that he was when the interrogatories were answered back in 2014, then if you look at the court rules, then if those answers were truthful when given, there is no duty to supplement once you've given truthful answers, because that would be never-ending. For every new person that comes into your life that may have ever observed your child or have some information, you would be supplementing answers.
What if it's a new treating physician in a personal injury case? Don't you have a duty to disclose that new physician?
I think you may have a duty. Well, I don't know that I would agree, Your Honor, because if you gave those answers early on and you fully disclosed at that time, I don't know that you would have to supplement that later. I mean, I'm just looking at the language of the rule that the court is promulgating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. How far did we take him over? Okay. Please add that to the appellee's time. Good morning, Mr. Adams.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I want to jump right into one of the last comments that Mr. Wagner made, that we don't know if the boyfriend was there or not. If we look at the appellant's affidavits, and she submitted two at that motion for new trial, she states very clearly in there that this was a two-year relationship with the boyfriend and they were making plans to get married. The boyfriend was there. She didn't disclose the boyfriend, and I get it. This is the type of work that I do on a day-in and day-out basis, and all the time when you're litigating the custody issue, you ask for the other side to identify persons with knowledge. And clearly the boyfriend wasn't identified. Clearly there is a line of balancing in these discovery requests between how far are you allowed to go? Are you on a fishing expedition? Yes, you are. How far are you allowed to cast that net to discover information? And people all the time don't disclose boyfriends, girlfriends, significant others. They don't want their personal communications with their significant others to be fair game in a custody case like this. And I get it. It's difficult. It comes up in the back and forth in the briefs. Why didn't I just request all of the text communication between the boyfriend and the appellant? If I had done that, Your Honors, I am quite certain that would have been met with the most strenuous of objections, because that type of a request without something more, the phrase that shows up in the reply brief is without reason to awaken inquiry, I'm going to get denied on the basis of it's too broad of a request.
Let's come at this another way. How long before trial did you know of the boyfriend?
Things happened pretty quickly on the eve of trial. I'm not sure I can answer that with any degree of definiteness. I do know that I had requested some time before, because there was a letter, I believe, attached to the motion. They refused to divulge that information pursuant to my my earlier discovery request. They didn't respond to my letter. I set the matter for a motion to compel. I believe I also, and I'm not 100% sure on this, the transcript would reveal it, I believe I also filed a motion for a continuance, which was denied. So I received the boyfriend information less than a week before trial started. There was no opportunity to depose him, as opposing counsel suggests. With all of the witnesses that were lined up in this case, a motion to continue so that I could do further discovery, that would have run into a brick wall. So here's another part behind me calling the boyfriend as a witness here. There's no guarantee that that would have produced any evidence with respect to the text messages or the photos.
But does that go to, you're kind of speculating here as to whether you would have been successful in these additional efforts. Doesn't this really go down to the due diligence?
It does.
Prong of the new trial?
It does, but I don't think it's speculation, Your Honor, from the standpoint that I had Ms. Grinnell on the witness stand for 2 hours, and without knowing what questions to ask, without having some inkling that these text messages exist or that these photos exist, it's just not natural to say, have you exchanged any naked pictures of yourself and your boyfriend back and forth between each other? That's not a natural question to ask in these cases, because there's 1,000 other questions that flow if you think that that's a natural question. Have you axe murdered anybody? Have you robbed any banks? Those aren't natural inquiries unless there is cause to awaken that inquiry. So I had Ms. Grinnell on the stand for 2 hours. She never, and I deposed her for another 3 hours before that, maybe even 4. She never gave me any indication of exchanges between her and her boyfriend. Now, I've been doing this long enough to understand that if you just keep looking and looking and looking and looking, eventually you do come to information that may be of some use in these custody cases. But the question is due diligence here. I believe that every case that opposing counsel cited in his brief that Mr. Kaiser's actions and my actions in this case as far as due diligence go far exceed anything that's in the case law. And I set those cases out and distinguished those cases in my brief. The dates is a big deal here. Was it before the trial or not? One of your honors made the comment that don't we see dates on some of those pictures? And we absolutely do. The dates, this is Exhibit 73 that we're talking about. We have dates on page 25. We have dates on page 29. We have dates on page 32. We have a very blurry date, but I think you can still make out March of 2015 on page 34. And on page 38, we have dates. All of those dates predate the trial in this case.
Now, are those pages relative to the photographs?
Yes.
What about the other text messages?
You don't have the luxury because I think opposing counsel makes a great point that the index on the left side does not match up with the date that those texts were exchanging. But there is a reference, and the trial judge made this point. From the context of those text exchanges, you can tell that those were exchanges that were going on while Project Harmony was doing their investigation. Here's another thing. April is mentioned in those text messages. April can't be any other date other than April of 2015. It can't be April 2016 because April 2016 hadn't happened yet. It probably can't be April 2014 because Lisa Vogel wasn't involved in the case yet. April is mentioned in those text exchanges, and that is a very clear indication, like the judge mentioned, that it was right smack dab in the middle of these investigations by CPS and Project Harmony. So we do have ways of figuring out the dates on the photos and the dates on the text messages. It's not abundantly clear for exact dates on all of the stuff, but some of it is pretty clear.
What about the fact that you didn't ask to subpoena boyfriend for any of the other hearings?
Your Honor, it goes back to what the comment that I made earlier, that I was on a fishing expedition with respect to that boyfriend. I didn't know what I was going to get. Opposing counsel made the comment in my motion to compel seeking his contact information that the boyfriend or the appellant may have made comments to the boyfriend about the case and perhaps about the plaintiff himself. You can't get any more generic than that. I didn't know what the boyfriend held. I didn't know what kind of information, but I knew that there was some potential for revealing information. What? I have no idea about texts. I have no idea about naked pictures going back and forth. So when I subpoenaed him on that first day for September 14th and September 15th at the trial dates, and my client testified that he made an effort to get him served, couldn't get him served, doesn't surprise me. Ms. Grinnell had no interest in her boyfriend taking that witness stand. And you get caught up in this trial and it gets continued for 2 months down the road and then another 3 months down the road. It's hard to stay up on that stuff. And I wasn't sure that there was anything there. It was a fishing expedition. There wasn't any indication that Taylor Cunningham was a gold mine of information. And this leads me into the last part of, is this merely cumulative? Opposing counsel touched on this. Is it sufficient to justify a new trial? And I think this runs into the abuse of discretion standard that is the appropriate standard of review in this case. Judge Sampson's comments go right to the heart of this, and he does mention that the mere possibility of the child having access to this, whether the child accessed it or not, that's not the issue. The child being put in a position where the child could have access to it. It is interesting also in the appellant's affidavit, she indicates that she had that iPod or that iPad since April of 2015. The child had access to that iPad since June of 2015, and the child was so adept on that iPad that she had figured out the passcode on her own. This is a 4-year-old little girl figuring it out on her own, and how do you do that? Through hundreds of hours of being on that iPad. If you look at appellant's affidavits at the motion for new trial, she lays out in her own words that the child had significant access to this iPad, but she claims that it was always under her supervision. Well, anybody that's a parent knows, you cannot provide that supervision 24/7, 365 days a year. So I think that's important. That's what made the judge grant my motion for new trial. And then obviously the text messages go directly to Mr. Kaiser's theory in this case that the initiation of abuse investigations by Project Harmony and CPS were not motivated by appropriate intent. They were motivated by the desire to interfere and minimize access to my client with the child.
Okay, thank you. You're okay. Out of time.
I have a question.
Okay.
Counsel, I have a question. What's the disadvantage between filing a motion for modification as opposed to for a new trial?
Well, obviously the standard, the burden is on Mr. Kaiser in a application to modify or complaint to modify. He's the one that carries the burden of proof. And then you're also only limited to the evidence that happened from the time the decree was entered, as a general rule you are, up until that time of the trial on that modification case. But
in this case, when you have information that was not available, why would it not be applicable?
Why would it not be an application to modify rather than a new trial? I don't think you get a fair treatment of the issue in an application to modify case. And this evidence is clear that it existed before that decree was entered. And Mr. Kaiser's theory in this case was so much tied to all of the things that happened in March and April of 2015 that I think filing an application to modify just based on those photos and those texts, I think Mr. Kaiser loses every day of the week and twice on Sunday in the revisiting of the custody issue.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
How far did we take him over?
A minute 34.
Do you want a minute and a half of rebuttal?
I think Judge Imbody was exactly correct. It should have been a motion for a new trial.
Motion for a new trial?
Or not a motion for a new trial, a complaint to modify. I do want to point something out, that the evidence in the text message, to the extent that it would be relevant, merely shows the same evidence that was presented at trial of a concerned mother who may have overreacted to some information. It doesn't show evidence of a nefarious plot. It doesn't show evidence of lying or scheming. She's talking about the child being in a bad situation, the child exhibiting some strange behaviors. This is all the evidence that was presented at trial. This is the same evidence that was presented at trial. It may be more of that evidence, but that's all it was. It was the same evidence. It doesn't form the basis for a new trial. And just lastly, regarding the photographs, again, there's no evidence that child ever saw those photographs. In fact, the affidavits show that you'd have to go through 1,800 text messages to get back to the photographs. The child didn't do that. The father did. The father got on there. We can't show it. We weren't there in North Dakota when he's going through this. But we had a dead iPad, as my client claimed. I'm not aware of a Lazarus model that comes back to life and can suddenly be trolled through. My client asked him, as stated in the affidavit, to keep the iPad away from the child. He ignored that. I think that it's pretty clear he went on there and scrolled through all this.
So as I understand it, the girl brought the iPad with her.
Correct.
And the mother told the father to keep the iPad away
Correct.
From her.
And it was dead. The battery was dead when the iPad went. So it had to be charged, and then it had to be accessed.
Why would she let it go in the first place?
That was inadvertent. It had been stuck in the child's bag in the back of the car. The child had been using it on the long trip. They meet in South Dakota to exchange the child for visitation.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you both for being here. We have the matter under advisement.